Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I can't imagine how they arrived at the version of doing it the way. I don't know why we're having this conversation. We can't talk. We can't say the name. Like, as much as I don't like what they do, I don't want to.
You can't put that.
Beep it all in post. Absolutely.
You're going to have to bleep it out, Allie. So every time we say it, just leave people to wonder what we could possibly be talking about. Tyler, feels like you got a turn in here.
Yeah, sure. All right, so Jonnet catches Metatron sort of like turn and like aim for them. And I think he's kind of doing the math on his like, all right, this is this could be crazy. This could be a hard thing to thread to needle to thread. And so he's going to grab his Kasari Gama and then he's going to reverse the way in which he's holding it. So I'd say that there's probably like a bit of like metal bar before you get to the sickle side of the Kasari Gama. He's going to grab that bar and instead with like the hilt, he's going to throw the hilt out to Nodos to be like, catch this, to try and like grab it and then like pull them in.
I will say Kasari Gamas do have two sides and one of them doesn't have a blade on it. It's just
yeah,
a
I know. Okay.
So yeah,
yeah, okay. But I don't want to throw the sickle side at Nodos and Metatron. So he's going to grab the sickle side. He's a martyr. He's like,
gotcha. Okay.
He's on purpose.
So if nothing else, he's just going to bonk him.
Yeah, that feels like that is either prowess or finesse, whichever you would prefer.
Well, you know, I've got more finesse than I've got prowess. Oh, wait, no. We're going all of prowess. Hang on. I just saw the, no. Yeah, I'm going to give four counts of prowess and we're going to shoot this shot. So those are D8s, right?
Yeah.
All right, so then I've got three, and then those get upgraded to 12?
Yes.
Okay. Dope.
Damn, John has got a lot of fucking prowess. Holy shit.
Prowess?
Am I overskilled? No, I don't.
You are the strongest boy.
I don't think you're overskilled.
Okay.
You just put a lot of prowess instead of intellect, which I think is interesting based on John's character.
Yeah, I'm remembering the choices that I made. All right, so then, so that is these are all on 12s, but we've got a 5, a 2, and an 11.
Okay. Damn. All right. Okay, so you got 3 opportunities out of this. You also got 2 successes out of this. Actually, it's only 2 opportunities, excuse me, because one does cancel out the complication that I rolled. This is really successful. I think everything comes together. Like, the winds are strong, so you really have to shoot this chain out at like a high speed. I think in Jonnet, in like swinging the weight to prepare for this, like, you can feel just how strong the wind is and just how much you have to like gather momentum in order to get it to shoot forward at all. And like, the danger here is like the links of the chain getting caught like mid throw and just falling short. So perhaps there is even like a moment where like Jonnet's eye, like the magic of Jonnet's eye pulses, and we can see like the light cascade down his arm into his swing.
It's very Gears of War when you're trying to like throw a frag grenade and you just see the line.
Yeah, that line just like extending out farther and farther until like you reach a point where it like holds and like it sails through the air, and the wind really does come at it. Like, you can see partway through the throw, the ways the like chain is starting to become slack because of how hard the wind is hitting it. But Nodos lunges forward in the saddle and grabs hold. I think he actually like has to basically climb out of the saddle and like lash the like safety line around one arm so that he could like jump off the bird and grab Jonnet's throw. But he has you secure now. Like, he starts to climb himself back onto the bird as Metatron banks to fly another circle around your group. And you have a secure line to Metatron. As long as the captain can hold you and Nodos can like hold that chain and Jonnet can hold that chain, you should be able to be pulled to safety by Metatron.
There are so many failure points in this chain. So yeah, I think as he's throwing it, he like, you know, gestures to the captain is like, hang on tight. And so he throws it. And then I think in Nodos grabbing it, there's like a very much like a jerking forward of like, and so I think that sort of tests the captain's grip, which I assume holds, but yeah.
Well, there are definitely opportunities to go around. So I kind of think that, yeah, the captain's grip does hold. As like Gable, who, you know, being such a physically powerful being, you might expect would be part of this effort to pull people together, but Gable has to concentrate their magical power to keep the captain aloft. It takes a lot to channel power into this fire to make the heat strong enough to keep them all like buoyant in the air, which is a great opportunity for us to cut back over to the Uhuru, because we have an effort to load up peat onto the ship that will give you enough peat to make your journey easier than it would be without that peat. But we also have a furnace that needs to be lit in order for the Uhuru to truly take flight. Mm-hmm. And not enough attention has been paid to the furnace. And also, our main crew is now out of threat from the cutting stone. The cutting stone's on the ground. Jonnet, Gable, and the captain are in the air. So there's not danger there. However, the crew members who are outside of the ship and the crew members who are aboard the deck, they face the wrath of the stone.
Mm.
So I'm actually going to start with the cutting stone rolling against the Uhuru crew. And there is one damage that will go towards the Uhuru.
Okay.
And I roll on the death chart a 26.
Oh, that's... Mm.
That is within range.
What's going on?
The result that I roll... is for a character whom I do not remember, but based on their description, I am forced to believe I roll Ethan Hawke, who is, and I quote, a hawk researching the role of being a human.
Okay.
I don't.
I don't remember them either, but hell yeah. Okay.
That's the only response.
26? Like,
yeah, like, that's sure. Like
pretty high.
You know what? I missed this. Okay, okay. A couple things have to occur now. Please set the scene of Ethan Hawke being attacked.
Is Ethan Hawke dead?
Oh, yeah. Ethan Hawke had 0 hit points.
No. Well, well.
We killed him.
Where is Ethan Hawke when Ethan Hawke is being attacked? Please do tell.
The only thing that I can picture Ethan Hawke, like, doing in this situation is being on the top of the deck, right? Mm-hmm, like, there's no way Ethan Hawke is, like, part of the effort to haul things onto the ship.
Sure.
I think Ethan Hawke, in this circumstance, really the best thing that he could hope to do is be working one of the lights aboard the ship. Because, like, you need to light the top deck. It's dark. It's storming right now. There are these headlights on the ship, which, you know, they use for guidance and whatnot. So he's, like, turned one of those lights, and he does have the power with his little beaks and wings and whatnot to move the light around. But he is, you know, wearing a coat. He's wearing, like, an oilskin coat because he's researching the role of being a human pirate for an upcoming stage production. And I'm going to establish that Ethan Hawke does have, like, a little mustache, like, attached to his beak. He takes this seriously, you know.
It's blowing in the wind.
And, you know, because this is the death of this character, we are going to flash back to some of his major moments.
Yeah.
We can see him in the mess hall eating a bowl of soup using a spoon. You know, he's gripping it in his little talon and, like, bringing it up because he insists to eat the way humans eat. We can see Ethan Hawke having what looks like a tender and almost romantic moment with another crew member aboard the ship because he insists to learn to love the way humans love in preparation for his role. We also see Ethan struggling to sleep in a hammock because he insisted that he must sleep the way a human sleeps. But it is not a comfortable roost the way he is used to. He's, like, flopped back, and it's difficult. But he is towards the edge of the ship. And Nathan, it did sound like you wanted to describe something about this, so I can turn the narrative power over to you.
There are two abilities I'd like to invoke in a row.
Uh-oh.
One, I would love to spend a point of presence for dramatic entrance to appear in a scene that I'm not in.
What a useful fucking ability that is.
Please don't leave. Please don't. We've dropped to the ground.
Oh, yeah.
Please.
Based on what is happening right now, I think this will create some problems, but I will allow it.
I mean,
it is one of your abilities.
I can have up in the air, we're in the human chain of Jonnet, myself, and then Gable, and Oromar.
Oh, yeah, I'm realizing your soul doesn't necessarily need to be a part of that whole.
Okay.
Let it rock. Okay. Hit me out.
Okay.
Let him cook.
With the hand holding on to Gable, hoist them upwards, flinging them up towards so they can actually grab onto the bird themselves, and Oromar lets go. And
I think that solves too many problems. I'm going to say that solves too many problems because that would be an action, like to get Gable and Jonnet into a safe position aboard the bird. But
I would love to ride a kick a dude out the air unexpectedly, saving a member of my crew. But if that won't fire right now, then that's fine. We'll let it go.
I'm going to meet you halfway on this, Nathan. Oromar could leave the body to hold Gable and Jonnet. Like, that, I feel, is solid. Because right now, the body is being held aloft by the feather weave. Gable is maintaining that feather weave in the air. All Oromar's body has to do is hold on tight to Gable and Jonnet, which doesn't require too much attention demanded from Orimar. So you could have your soul, the little samurai. Well, I'm trying to remember the name of that comic.
The shaman king looking orb.
Yeah,
the shaman king
Orimar soul ball could rocket forth from Orimar towards the Uhuru.
Sure.
Because it's like I'm doing as much as I can here, and there is more to oversee. I will definitely allow you to enter this scene, and as a spirit, you would be able to attack the cutting stone.
Yes, because the second ability I would want to invoke, we don't have a name for it, but with a reputation spend, I can leap in the way of a death chart roll that's nearby. So by placing myself in the scene and next to this attack to about to occur, the soul of Orimar Vale, rider kicks whatever cutting stone spirit is about to rend the life of Ethan Hawke.
Yes!
So we can see the steely silver knife of the cutting stone behind Ethan Hawke, who is, you know, extremely invested in the scene. We can see this is an incredibly emotive face for a Hawke. Like, you can tell why Ethan got the job and that mustache. Ethan takes his job seriously. He is like,
a good little opportunity.
You can see that the Hawke eyes are just full of concern and intensity. As he is watching the scene around the furnace unfold, and he does not see the knife behind him. I will say, Nathan, what this ability is doing, this is not you pushing the cutting stone out of the way. This is you jumping in the way of the blow.
Yes,
this is
absolutely.
Orimar, like, please describe Orimar stopping this knife from cutting down this bird.
Yeah, I think we see the ball of soul move with this kind of squash and stretch. It's speeding towards the cutting stone, extending out. And then as the knife of the cutting stone is about to go and make the swing, the soul comes in contact, and there's a big flash of like neon sea green. And as the flash recedes, it is like a spiritual duplicate having kind of taken on the form of the captain, as the, we're going to catch it in the teeth, proper pirate style.
Oh my gosh. And like here, this amazing thing, like, I think there are only certain members of the crew that can even see that this is happening. Ethan Hawke would be one of them if he was not so like completely focused on the scene and his work, immersed in the job. But yeah, you have saved Ethan Hawke's life. Ethan Hawke, who had 0 hit points, does not lose those hit points from the Uhuru death chart roll.
Hell yeah.
Because of that chain of abilities that you created for Orimar.
Hell yeah. Love to spend 2 stat points to save a nobody.
to save again, I cannot
to be a man.
Researching the role of being a human.
This is the sort of thing that really changes an actor's life. Makes them really
echoing spiritually in the air of Ethan Hawke. The human soul is indomitable. How much damage do I take from taking a hit on the death chart instead of a person?
Yeah, I am going to say, well, it's going to be 4 damage.
Okay.
Where do we list our damage?
Interesting. So a point on the death. So you know, the audience at home who are doing the math, 1 HP of the crew is equal roughly to 4 vitality of us.
That's good to know.
Well, this is in this situation.
Fair enough.
This is with what the cutting stone
how those
put
attacks
out as
work.
Damage.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So we're now aboard the Uhuru itself. Around the furnace, there are 3 furnaces. There is the main furnace in the center where I assume Carlos is working, but there is the fore and the aft furnace as well. We are trying to get these fires lit and stoked as high as they can so that the ship can actually take off. Who is doing what? You can jump in with any members of the Uhuru crew, or we can also cut over to Min and Granny Softspot, who have now lashed up everything to Metatron, and it's a matter of hauling it all aboard to close out that little story arc. It's whatever people feel.
I feel like Wendell smokes rope. Mm-hmm. I feel like Wendell probably has...
I partake every now and then, yeah.
You smoke, my guy. All right. I feel like Wendell might have... Because the goal... We're trying to actually spark this flame.
Yeah, Wendell is... I believe he was down with the group of hauling things, but he could also very quickly climb the side of the ship. He is extremely strong. So
very strong, very, very beefy. I mean, I just imagine like either Wendell or Toku probably have something to Wendell, probably like a rope lighter that is like better for like, you know, sparking than your typical apparatus. And then Toku probably also has either that or some kind of like just like matches that he keeps on him at the ready as our chef. And I feel like one of them, or maybe both of them, making a break for the furnace to try and like actually spark up this fire makes sense
to
me.
Let's go to Toku because it's we haven't checked in with Toku in a grip. So I like the idea. One of my favorite matches in all time in human history are these kind of very bright strike anywhere matches that existed, I think it was like in the 1800s generally, but we're playing in that space, called Lucifers. So I love like Toku just carrying around a pack of Lucifers.
Yes. And so I think like we see like we're on the deck. Like Toku is like kind of bobbing and weaving around like the silhouettes of the Cutting Stone members. And I think he's like, at this point, he's like keyed into the fact that like the rain is hitting something. Avoid the thing that the rain is hitting. And I think he's making his way, making a break for the furnace itself. And they're called Lucifers.
Yeah.
And I think like he rushes up again, like up towards Carlos. He looks like you could use some assistance, and he like pulls out this like little matchbox, and maybe there's like a moment of like there's a moment on Toku's face where it's like, you son of a bitch. And it's like, yeah, so it's like, I always keep a few for the hard to light fires. And he like pops the, like, maybe he puts it underneath his, he shields it with his body from, like, the rain as best as he can, and then, like, strikes three, and immediately strikes them and throws them into the furnace.
And these shine bright. You know what? In this universe, why not call them morning stars? Like, I think that's pretty beautiful. Absolutely. And they burn with this like bright white fire, and it creates that shape of the morning star, that 13-pointed star. And it like they tumble into the furnace. Tyler, I would like you to make a roll here.
Yeah, sure, why not? What exactly am I rolling
so
for?
Right now it is 1d8. Okay. You are just rolling to contribute to this furnace stoking effort.
That's a 4.
Okay. All right. We once again come to a point where I have to pull a luminary, as we have canceled out successes and failures here. The children.
Yes.
Yeah, this does feel like you have pulled a lot of favorable luminaries here. Consequence, inevitability, and eternity. Ooh. Nothing was unobserved, and a reckoning is coming. Well, I am going to say inevitability, we do have this fire that we are trying to light, and I do believe we are going to make progress on that. So I'm going to mark that off. But we also have consequence. And we have this imagery of the Morning Star, who we know is the entity that called the Cutting Stone to attack the Uhuru in the first place. So I am going to roll on the death chart as well.
I don't need to do that.
I do, though. I do. And I get an 8. And an 8 is Fuentes. Of Daisy and Fuentes. Recently widowed to be Fuentes, formerly of Daisy and Fuentes. Fuentes and Daisy were characters originally so insignificant they had 0 hit points. So as soon as Daisy was rolled, Daisy died. However, Fuentes did have 1 hit point because they had the tragedy of losing Daisy to add to their character.
Tragedy creating protagonists.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing. The Cutting Stone seek out souls in despair as their targets. So we have over in the aft furnace, we see Fuentes struggling to shovel enough dry peat into the furnace without it getting wet. Their arms are failing. They are tired. And in moments like this, Fuentes would look to Daisy, their brow mate, as I will remind everybody that Daisy and Fuentes had a unibrow, but a unibrow that like kind of went off to one side. So if they put their heads together, they would have one long eyebrow across them. That is one of the things.
Why were we allowed to create that?
Why? JPC was on the show. There was a lot of like questionable things added to the mythology of what we were doing.
Incredible.
But without their brow mate at their side, there is a faltering, and we can see behind them the flash of a knife of the Cutting Stone stab into their side. Fuentes feels the pain and sorrow spread through their body, like the arms of a river branching across the land. It moves across Fuentes's soul. However, Fuentes is not conquered yet. Fuentes has spent long weeks and months grieving this friend, grieving the other half of their soul. And how is that different from now? How is that different from this moment where the crew and the other people who have guided them through this grief depend on their ability to move? And so, shaking, they take that shovel and they stick it further into the peat and they shovel on. Essentially, no selling, being stabbed in the side. They did not see it happen. They felt the pain, they felt the sorrow. But what is pain and sorrow to someone who is grieving the greatest friend they have ever known? And they work through it. And slowly, the flames of the furnace rise higher. Not enough to bring the ship aloft, though, as we continue on. Hello, heroes. It's James, your game master, and it's good to talk to you again. After a long stretch of editing my newest book and going to conventions, I am glad to just do a real mid-roll announcement. Speaking of that new book that I just finished editing, I have a new Ultimate RPG guide coming out in March. It is the Ultimate RPG Game Master's Guide. So if you like the way that I run this game on this show or any of my other shows, and if you're looking for an advice book that unpacks my approach to RPGs, The Game Master's Guide is exactly what you're looking for. I'm really proud of this book. It includes some vital advice that I don't think I've seen present in any guide that I've seen, like how to manage interpersonal conflicts. I actually got a therapist to consult on that one. And of course, there is so much more structural advice for you, like how to manage and pace the plot and encourage roleplay. Once again, that's coming out in March, wherever books are sold. You can pre-order by heading to bit.ly/ultimategamemaster or bit.ly/gamemasterRPG. But once again, it's available wherever books are sold, including major brick and mortar like Barnes & Noble, all online retailers, and of course, your favorite friendly brick and mortar game store. And if you want to get it, be sure to pre-order because it really helps me out. Here's, I'm hoping to see some of you in a few days at New York Comic Con. If you happen to be attending that event, I'll be joined by Jeff and John from System Mastery for the RPG Game Show Friday at 1:30 p.m., and that will be immediately followed by a signing. And usually we have much shorter lines than all the celebrities around us, so you will get a lot of personal time to just hang out with me and talk. As always, I want to send a huge thank you to our backers on Patreon. Our patrons make this show possible and everything that we produce on the network. Right now, we are back in a new season of Starwall. We have new episodes of that coming out every other week for the next couple of months. And there's going to be new Skyjacks bonus content on the way soon. A huge thanks to everybody who supports us already and everyone who's going to support us in the future. Now then, a quick word from our sponsor. And with all that out of the way, let's get back in the sky. Who is up next?
Let's Carlos for a bit. If Carlos's furnace is now in the position where it's operating well, or does it still need to get where it needs to be? Maybe they take a run over to the aft furnace to get the final one going.
Oh, sure. So Carlos dashes towards the aft furnace. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Again, there is this chain of people shoveling into. We can see there are embers in there, but the fire is in a delicate position right now. Mm-hmm. It could, if it is not fed enough, it will not gather heat quickly enough. However, if it is fed too much, it could be smothered. This is one of the reasons that you have a dedicated furnacer.
Mm-hmm. We're in a difficult position here, but I think we can get the balance of it.
And they go to their waist and they've abandoned the goggles, I think, and are not concerned currently about keeping the fact that they have an eye missing under wraps and probably spook at least one person running up to this line of people shoveling peat into the furnace. They go to one of the flasks at their waist and start trying to, you know, get a steady burning ignition kind of fluid going that will help straddle that line of burning quickly and not burning quickly enough as new peat is added. Good thing there is a generic roll here because I wouldn't know what to roll for chemistry. I guess it'd be intellect. Just to check them. We are
one white. Yeah.
Cool. We do have a point of fate still going. Sorry, I'm losing it.
Oh yeah, you do have plenty of fate.
Yeah. Spending two fate would put me to 2d8, yeah?
That is correct.
Sick, let's do that. That's a 2 and a 5.
A 2 and a 5.
On d8s.
Hey, that's great. That is 2 successes and an opportunity. The opportunity does get canceled out, but you definitely need to keep canceling out those complications. So 2 successes is going to stoke the fire higher.
All right.
And yeah. I am happy to report the fires in the furnace roar to the point where it is actually having an effect on the envelope. We can see the envelope aboard the Uhuru slowly start to push out, light up, and we can see the beginning of crimson light start to dance across the envelope as the ship is preparing itself to take flight. It rocks against the structure that you've built in the port to accommodate the ship as it begins its ability to ascend. We're not quite at the point where we can ascend yet, but we are very nearly there. Mm-hmm. The cutting stone is going to attack the crew once more. Mm. Oh my goodness. Brutal. there are three hits that I'm going to be rolling against the death chart right
this
now.
This is fine. It's fine.
48. So there was only one character committed to the most recent action. So that doesn't affect anyone. 9. Oh. That definitely affects someone. Mm. Okay. I'm going to deal with that in 1 second. And 13 is also going to affect the death chart. Whoa! Oh, this is huge. Uh-huh. This is absolutely enormous. So the first character that I rolled on the Uhuru death chart is Overboard. Overboard is the HR pirate. Overboard being the HR pirate does have more than one hit point.
Yeah, yeah he does.
So we cut to Overboard. Like everybody is on these lines in front of the furnaces. Like working to shovel, working to keep the peat dry, working to make sure like peat is dried out using various like magical techniques and whatnot. Overboard has to move up and down these lines because some of these crew members are working overtime shifts. And so he has to do the paperwork, get them to say, like document, like, okay, your overtime shift is starting now, you see.
No.
You're not helping.
Believe you me, you'll be thankful when you get the extra coin in your coffers. There are men who fought and died and struck for these rights, and you'd be well to honor their legacy now. I just need you to sign here and initial here.
Behind you.
I'm being stabbed.
Now, what's this behind me, you say? Overboard turns around and manages to, like, see. I think Overboard is someone who's got an eye patch. So Overboard has also lost an eye. Does not have a magical flower that allows them to see through that eye or anything, but carries enough death within their living body that Overboard sees, like, the faintest glint of a cutting stone knife in the air. And there was a warning calling out that, like, the cutting stone is stalking the crew. So Overboard raises up the pile of paperwork as the knife stabs down and the point stops just before it would reach Overboard's chest and heart. Overboard stumbles back and looks at the hole in the paper and goes, "Ah, there's so much extra paperwork to do now. Curses!
Get under!
No.
Get in the ship!
No. So Overboard is fine. However, I also rolled a 13 on the Uhuru death chart for a character who normally would have more than one hit point. However, this character is portrayed normally by Johnny O'Mara. And without Johnny to support them, I don't know that those hit points count.
Well, you this can't is, change it now. That's not
this
fair.
This is Fella Ferretti.
No!
Our current head cook aboard the Uhuru and Guy Fieri analog aboard the ship, I will take their one hit point down to 0.
You can't.
Well, it's down to 0, so they're not dead
not
yet.
Dead,
they haven't been hit
you
on the 0.
Should not.
And Liz, since you are so defensive of Fella Ferretti,
yes.
I would like you to describe Fella Ferretti's near death, but not actual death experience.
Fella Ferretti, known coward, has been underneath most of this time because sometimes the best thing you could do to help is just getting out of the way. But he forgot something very, very important on the top side, and that is his safety goggles. He's making a particularly potent soup, and he always needs to wear his safety goggles. Typically, they're on the back of his head, but he couldn't find them. So he's damn
I'm
it.
Cutting up all these onions and the flavor's blasting my face and eyes.
Damn it all to hell. He has to finish this soup. So he goes topside to go search for his safety goggles. Mm-hmm. And all you see in the dark and the thunderstorms are flashes of white tips, almost ghost-like, appearing in different areas of the ship. Frosting, if you will. Until he gets to one of the main masts and realizes, like, oh, damn, this is a pretty flavorsome situation that I find myself in. Perhaps too powerfully flavorful, because sometimes the best flavor is well-balanced flavor. And as he's talking to himself, a part of the cutting stone, like, really just gets him through the mouth. Like, misses his tongue, so he's still got the taster in there, but he can't talk anymore.
The taster.
And that's why he doesn't sound like Johnny anymore.
Right.
Pouring, there we go. Pouring from his mouth is a mixture of blood and donkey sauce.
He's got like a, it would normally be like a suicide capsule that you bite down hard on, but it's filled with donkey sauce.
Yeah. Keep it in there for emergencies.
You'll never take me unseasoned.
Yes.
He falls down and it pulls through his mouth, and then he reaches up to says someone and says, why so curious? Oh,
great. That is the attack of the cutting stone against the Uhuru crew. I think it's time to cut down to the ground to the line of pallets that are lashed up to the powerful back of our dear friend Flea, being commanded by Granny Softspot and Min. So what's happening down there? I think we need really just a roll to haul this stuff aboard the ship. Mm-hmm.
There's probably some kind of like, that's enough. Whatever we have, we're going to make do with. And so, again, Granny holds up her cane, like the handle in the air, and just kind of like smacks a Flea on the backside to get him up and in the air.
All right. Well, it doesn't need to be in the air because, like, literally it just needs to walk forward onto the ship.
Yeah, all this stuff.
So this is going to be rolling 2d8s because we have Min, Granny Softspot, and Flea committed to this action.
And that is an 8 and a 3.
8 and a 3. Let's see here. Oh, dip. Okay, so actually just a failure. You do get two points of fate from this, but Flea takes a step forward and there is too much weight against him. Like everybody is pulling alongside Flea. Everybody's trying to haul these pallets forward. But right now there's too much weight holding people back. Because there is a failure, we get another roll on the Uhuru death chart. That is a 97, so no one suffers for that failure. Okay. But like right now, there is too much weight. We need more force behind this effort to haul things aboard the ship. What do you do?
Min has teen daring do, but not absurd physical strength. But I think...
Well, there is another character we could commit to this action.
Yeah.
Who does have absurd physical strength. And that is Wendell Barge, who happens to be with you. Wendell would take a new roll up to 2d8s and 1d6. You also have several points of fate. Nathan, you're in charge of this one.
Oh, sure.
What are you going to do?
I did roll for Carlos, didn't I?
We're playing in a nebulous space. This is the crew.
Fair
Everybody
enough.
Controls
oh,
the
yeah,
crew.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, that sounds good. So that is 2d8, 1d6, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah, no. Wendell, I think, hand in the pouring ring, reaches out of frame to kind of also grab alongside the harness attached to Flea and starts to pull alongside with the necrotic superpowered arm. Like, okay. On the D8s, that is a 7 and an 8. And on the 6, it is a 6.
Okay.
Which, you know, that sounds good to me.
It is good. You have opportunities here. However, we once again hit a situation where successes and failures canceled out, and we must consult the luminaries. The bounty, though, comes. The bounty is unambiguously positive for the crew. All working together, I think this hauls the procession aboard the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it does so in a way that we don't have to worry about any further roles in the death chart. Wendell truly made the difference. I think it is Wendell, like, put himself in a position that really leverages his arm more so than anything else. But with that, like, this dragging procession starts moving things across the ground. Whatever logs and things that you have set out to roll the pallets, like, starts moving. Flea scrambles onto the ship, and the heavy pallets move behind them. The Uhuru has plenty of peat aboard the ship. You are not going to have to worry about what would have happened if you looked like you were falling short of your intended destinations. Mm-hmm. So bully for you. Let's cut to the top deck once more. There is just a little bit more that the furnace has to go before those fires are lit enough to get things into the air. At this point, the furnaces are lit. It is a question of bellows. Normally in the air, when the ship is moving through the sky, there are ways to capture wind and funnel them into furnaces so that they can be stoked quite quickly. However, on the ground, there are still manual bellows that need to be pumped. Mm-hmm. So what does that effort look like?
There was a lot of people with the kind of a lot of the at least the young members of the crew kind of scattered out to kind of help with the shoveling, right? And now the task has changed, so it feels almost Pikmin-esque. People are now filing back onto the ship and scurrying around to the new position.
Yeah. People are gathering around.
I feel like it's in a similar shot where it's like we watch a top down shot of the mob get back on the ship, and then we see who would be handing them out, but like somebody's handing out. I just imagine like tight shots of like someone handing billows to pet people as they like snatch them up and like rush towards the furnace to like really get the air going. And let's say, what's Jane doing? It's either Jane or my the first person I saw was Timmy the Lips.
Jane, I think is a great person to lead an effort. That is the position that she puts herself in, generally speaking. So we've got Jane on her own 1d8, but you do have a pile of 4 points of fate to spend as you like.
Pile of fate.
2 points.
All right.
2 points. Okay, so that is 2d8 and a d6.
D6. So that is going to be on the D8, a 7 and a 3. On the D6, a 2.
2 on the D6. Hey, you have a success. So that does get you one step closer to the Uhuru being able to take off. I think, like, the ship is now raises to the points where you're able to undo the ties that you had on the ground that were positioning it in the dock. The ship is going to be ready to pull away into the air imminently. The crimson on the sails is burning bright and high. You also, I think, now have like pulled into the air to the point where you had opportunities. And I'm going to say the wind tubes, like the wind battering the ship is strong enough that it could actually work to help stoke the furnaces at this point. So the next roll is going to be juiced. You are going to have a volatility dive rolling in your favor for helping the ship take off. Let's cut over to... I want to actually cut to Orimar. Orimar, your spiritual form is aboard the ship. You are one of the only people capable of fighting against the cutting stone as it attacks the crew. I just want to know what Orimar is doing to aid in that effort.
Okay.
It feels like kicking ass just as the soul is a magic roll. But I did spend a bar of magic. One of the abilities in our designing session was soul transfer, a passive ability where I can spend vitality to recover points in magic.
Oh yeah.
We did not discuss about the ratio of vitality spend to magic spend, whether it's 1-to-1 or like 2-to-1.
I think it would be 2-to-1 because vitality is like cheaper than stat points.
Sounds good. I'm going to spend 6 vitality to get me back up by 3 points, putting me at 4 points of magic.
Perfect.
I have to do some maths. Sorry. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think when we last saw, it was having formed back into an approximation of Orimar. I think it's not a perfect replica. There is a little bit of, I mean, we already kind of described the soul space is slightly technological, and I think this is if Orimar was hewn from chunks of crystal, very fighting polygon team energy. Mm-hmm. And this soul manifestation of Orimar steps onto the ship and pulls. I think this form has like is holding a sword, even though, you know, weapons are arbitrary. Just this kind of reflection of Orimar is always armed with a sword.
Yeah.
And I'm going to spend a bunch of points of magic and start going to town trying to rebuff the advances of the cutting stone.
Ooh, roll your attack.
Sure. My magic base is 1d8 and 1d6. If I spending 1 point would upgrade that to 2d8.
Okay, hell yeah.
Would a second point upgrade that to 1d12, 1d8?
You wouldn't. Yes, it would.
Sure. Okay, so I'm going to spend 2 points of magic and roll 1d12 and 1d8. That is a 5 on the D12 and a 3 on the D8.
Okay. So what I think is happening, you rolled a bunch of opportunities another point of fate here. So what I think Orimar is doing is merely drawing the attention of the cutting stone and positioning them away from the mm-hmm. efforts to fuel the fire. So Orimar like is basically like clashing, knocking aside blows from cutting stone, but rather than trying to cut them down, he is trying to draw them towards him.
Yeah.
And I think there is even Orimar is going through a very difficult emotional psychic period right now because he is being burned for his sins, right? Like that is still pain that his body that he is spiritually experiencing. But also the cutting stone are attracted to sorrow and guilt and such.
Mm.
So Orimar is using the pain from the fire that is burning him for sin to prevent himself from falling completely into despair. But he is also focusing on those painful memories so that he can call out to the cutting stone and draw himself forward as a target.
Mm.
So it is this kind of harrowing and heroic scene as Orimar darts across the deck and desperately fights back a larger and larger wave of opponents.
What I've done in the past hurts me more than your knives ever will.
All right, Tyler, we need somebody to take us home on lighting this furnace. Mm-hmm. Give me one more action from a member of the crew to finish us off. I think it's time to take out the big guns. I think we need Bathroom Barry.
Crawling out of the tube.
Yeah. this is Cannon Barry.
Cannon Barry.
This is out of cannon. All right, so I feel like there is a... it's crazy, you wouldn't hear it, but like you feel like footsteps like coming up from below deck, and I think that there is a like you see Barry explode out from below deck with a tarp covering up like something. Mm-hmm. And we see like Barry comes like, make way. And I feel like the folks that are still on the deck that are kind of like fighting off the cutting stone, like try to like push and maneuver and just like clear a path for Barry to get there. And I think Barry runs up and then like pulls off the tarp to reveal, like, here's the thing, like, You're a craftsman of balsa wood. That means you always have like a supply of scrap and like loose pieces of balsa. And so I think he takes these loose pieces and essentially just like chucks them into the furnace, and it like acts as a level of like more kindling, and just like it's also very, very, very soft, very light, very easy to like burst into flame. And I think that adds to the overall like heat that we're trying to accumulate.
Mm-hmm. What a sacrifice. Yeah.
Tyler, roll your 2d8.
Yaw.
You were going to be boosted plans for that balsa. Volatility dice.
Boom. That is a 6 and a 1.
A 6 and a 1. Excellent. Excellent. We have the successes we need to take this into the air.
Yeah.
With the balsa wood, the fires and the Uhuru roar to life, the crimson of the Uhuru sails lights up the night. Every occupant of Haven across the island can see the crimson red in the sky as the Uhuru rises up. It is immediately buffeted by winds. And we can see Bowser now returned to the helm, holding tight on the wheel, pulling on the levers to get the side sails back into position. But the Uhuru is able to take flight. We can see Metatron soaring towards the ship and finding purchase, I think on like the grips and the side to welcome the griffins back into the hull of the ship, but it is actually able to pull away. We can see Cerise silently watching the ship pull into the sky, kind of underlit by the silver fires near the river where she stands with her iron crook looking up at the sky, signing towards whether it is Gable or the Uhuru, we do not know. But the sign is right wrongs, do mercies, take flight. Sky Jacks.
So we see Nodos going through the corridors and hallways aboard the Uhuru down to the meticulously kept bathrooms on the lower decks of the Uhuru. He gently pushes open the balsa wood door and is met not just with the beautiful visage of the marbled bathroom with beautiful dark wood paneled walls and many carved and molded sconces and beautiful pipeworks aboard the Uhuru, but also with Bathroom Barry, the ship's quartermaster and bathroom attendant, pointing at an identical copy of Bathroom Barry, the ship's quartermaster and bathroom attendant.
I'm the real Bathroom Barry. Shoot him.
I was hoping to make use of the facilities. I don't know. It's not exactly an urgent matter, but I don't know that I...
You can't leave.
Oh, I don't know that I have time to deal with all of this.
Nodos, you cannot leave. All right, I knew this day would come. In order for me to work so quickly and diligently with all the balsa wood and materials here, I had to clone myself. And so there
means Nodos, please make yourself at home and use the facilities. We'll be here resolving.
All right, right now I am inclined to just believe one of you because that does seem like the quickest route to, again, the sort of pressing reason that I came here, which is bathroom related. Yes. So,
yeah, so Nodos, take out your javelin and javelin this other berry, this fake berry.
Please. You don't need to do that. All you just need to do is settle down and enjoy your time here. Well, we have a discussion about the person who needs to be decommissioned. You've been slacking, Bathroom Barry. I wouldn't clone somebody like you. You're not up to standards.
I am not a clone. I am the original, the OGB, OG Barry. All right. And at that, he takes out a knife that is clearly carved out of balsa wood. And I'm prepared to fight to the death for what is mine.
Okay. If your duties are too numerous for you to handle on your own, you can delegate. There are other people aboard the crew, and you technically occupy like a position of authority. There's no need to clone yourself or anything like that to see your duties done, Barry.
This would be a delightful lesson for us to have learned before we went on this Faustian bargain that we set ourselves on, but ultimately...
Why is your clone slightly southern? That's what I want to know. That's where I'm at.
It's the berries degrade over time. All right, if they start out smooth, and then at a certain point it becomes southern, and that's when they start to get ideas, and that's usually when it's a good idea to get rid of them. Which I'm sorry, but I have to do. And he turns the knife back on the clone berry. Stand down.
Barry, I know all of your moves. And the moment that you kind of turn around, there is a similar mirror image pose of this bathroom Barry with the same kind of balsa wood knife held point to point.
Now, I'm aware that every question I ask is one more step away from the bathroom that I, again, did come here to use, and it wasn't an urgent issue initially, but
by all means
is getting more urgent by the sec. How many clones in are we? Did it jump to southern right away? Was there another variation on Bathroom Barry before we got here?
Well, it did start immediately with Southern, but through time and research and crafting with Dref, we managed to push out the Southern phase by months, and that it was a happy life. We could have the berries we needed to get the work that needed to be done, and then we had time to dispose of them. But now the southerning is happening faster. This is all being delivered while there is like matched knife fighting all over. There's somehow there's sparks being flown from the balsa wood knives.
Over time, because the bathroom is so large and we continue to move down this kind of like endless corridor of various stalls and baths available, and eventually there is a privacy curtain for what has been for the longest time marked as the private bathroom. And as far as nobody knows, and nobody's used it, you want to know how many previous barriers there were?
Don't do this. Don't do this.
Not necessarily. Again, mostly my interest is related to using the facilities, but I have been kind of swept up in all of this, and it feels like you're going to reveal something to me anyway.
Well, let me tell you how many berries I've been fighting.
Sure. Fine. Yes, please.
Pulling back the private bathroom curtain for a floor-to-ceiling clear-glassed tube of just multiple berries, innumerable and suspended animation within.
It feels like this adds a lot of weight to the ship, Barry. I know it's not my department. I know technically you are higher up on me in the order of command, but it just feels like this is a lot of weight to dedicate to one part of the ship, one set of duties aboard the ship.
You're in this now. Lived and died for you, Nodos.
Get back in that tube where you belong.
Never. I will avenge my brethren.
I thought we disposed of the previous berries. You put them in tubes?
They're in tubes until we port.
So this is just how many berries have been disposed of between ports.
In the last fortnight, yes.
Barry, buddy, come on.
You have to free us.
You've gotta be able to just take a half step out of this and just come on and see it the way that I'm seeing it. Can you do that?
Do you want your bathrooms this clean? And then they both take a perfect pause so we can all take in the beauty and majesty of this marble bathroom. And then they start back up again. Do you want the bathrooms this clean?
Okay, admittedly, yes, I do. There is no part of me that wants us to return to the way bathrooms were before and the way bathrooms have been on other ships that I have experienced. But
now you know the truth, Nodos. You have two options. You can either fight for the Barrys that have been slain in this illicit, disgusting ritual that has been wrought, or you can perish before you can spread the word.
I will say, though, it is an important distinction. The berries that are in that tube are not technically dead, all right? They are in a state of cryo sleep. They will be disposed and when we get to port, but as they could pop off at a moment's notice, which is why I need to slay you and you can't be...
But what are their souls, Barry?
My choice is to... either have clean bathrooms or right the cosmic injustice that has been written by creating lives just to be disposed of, what looks like in the countless dozens. Is that what I'm to understand?
You're picking up what we're putting down, yeah?
All right, Nodos throws the spear directly into the chest of the clone Barry.
Look, man, you gotta sort out your shit, okay?
I will. We just have to get rid of... We gotta get to port, and I'm gonna get rid of this last cryo tube, and then I'm going straight. Back to the way it was.
Lurid pink ichor splatters across the ground from the back of slain Barry as it walks across the perfect tiled floor over to Nodos. Before I go, your short collar is askew, and he adjusts it slightly and then slumps to his knees. Beautiful.
Look, man, I know you went on a vacation recently, but we gotta figure out something, because you are way too deep.
No, it's
says... fun. As he's disappearing in one of the stalls and closes the door.
No, it's fine. It's fine. See, his blood is also a cleaning solution. I'll clean it up. It'll be gone by the time you get out. Don't tell Gable. Don't tell Gable.
Campaign Skyjacks is a One-Shot Network production. For more information, be sure to follow us on Twitter over @CampaignPod for updates about live shows and other events we might be doing.
In the universe of Starwall Odyssey, space is made out of the collective imaginations of all the thinking beings who live on various planets. These worlds are connected to each other through imagination. Common themes and ideas are strings between universes.
And to get between them, people fly wooden ships that look like animals, which are powered by emotions.
Also, people communicate with each other by contemplating orbs.
The only way you can take pictures is getting stared at by a big psychic bug.
And people have already declared victory in a war over the very concept of evil.
But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Starwall Odyssey follows the adventures of the hapless inhabitants of the Lucky Finn tenement building, who suddenly find that their apartment is actually a spaceship, and that they're lost in a sea of boundless imagination. It's an actual play starring me, James D'Amato, Mel D'Amato, Ali Grauer, and Drew Merzieski, as we playtest the No Kings system, which will hopefully one day be the Skyjacks role-playing system. It toes the line between weird and wonderful slice of life and high-flying space fantasy. You can sample the first 5 episodes by searching for Starwall Odyssey on your favorite podcast app, or get the whole thing by heading to patreon.com/oneshotpodcast and signing up for $5 a month or more.
You can find more great gaming shows over at oneshotpodcast.com.
Jonnet Kessler was played by Tyler Davis, who can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Tyler A. Dave. Tyler is on strike alongside his fellow members of the WGA and SAG-AFTRA. You can support Tyler and other striking artists by contributing to the Entertainment Community Fund, linked in our show notes. Gable was played by Liz Anderson, who can be found on Twitter at @LizAnderson_... or on her podcast, Paired. Captain Oromar Vale was played by Nathan Blades, who can be found on Twitter at @PhantomArtsENT, or streaming at twitch.tv/TheNeonCaster. I am James D'Amato, your host and game master. You can find me on Twitter at OneShotRPG, or on my podcast, One Shot. The original music featured in this podcast was written, composed, and performed by Arnie Parrott. You can find him over on Twitter at Arnie Parrott, or on his website, ATP Tunes. This episode was edited by Allie Grauer, who can be found on Twitter at Dreams to Become, or on her podcast, Skyjack's Courier's Call. Our logo was designed by Fiona Shea, who can be found on Twitter at Lunarum. The World of Sphere was inspired in part by the music of the Decemberists and Illimat, produced by Together Studios. This show was made in part by using a modified version of the Genesis role-playing system, designed by Sam Stewart and a team of talented professionals. There are no kings. Take flight.
Health to the strangers who've ever been kind, and once for our friends ne'er to rise. Twice to the dearest we're leaving behind, who know we can never deny the call of the skies.